If you could take up Bibles again, it's page 896. We're going to carry on our series in John's Gospel. We've been working through it section by section. We're now at chapter 10, John 10, 896 in the Bibles. Also, on the inside of your sheet, some notes, because we're going to look at it in detail in a moment, and the notes will help you. John chapter 10, following straight on from the healing of the blind man we saw last week, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the gatekeeper opens. The sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers." This figure of speech Jesus used with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So Jesus again said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved, and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he's a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep. And I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd. For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This charge I have received from my Father." There was again a division amongst the Jews because of these words. Many of them said, "He has a demon and is insane. Why listen to him?" Others said, "These are not the words of one who's oppressed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind?" Do keep that open. It's been observed that there are some people in our society who seem to get away with all kinds of misdemeanors, indiscretions, which if the same offenses were perpetrated by others, they would be jumped on very harshly and immediately. And one commentator I was reading on this phenomenon said this: "Let's say an environmentalist drives some metal spikes down the middle of some trees so that loggers have their chainsaws kicked back and seriously injure them. If this comes up at a press conference at the campaign headquarters of some environmentalist charity, the representative will say something like, 'While we don't necessarily approve of such extreme tactics, we do need to keep this behavior in context. By opening up this wilderness area to logging, the government has put the native habitat of the grey-tufted titmouse in great peril.'" Whereas, and this is the same commentator, he's contrasting, he says, if there is, let's say, an English Defence League rally in Parliament Square and someone leaves an empty drinks can behind, that kind of disrespectful behaviour will be taken as representative of the general wickedness that the group represents. Now, please don't mishear me. I'm really not trying to back the EDL. I'm not trying to make any kind of political comment at all, except to say, to illustrate that every culture, Every culture has groups within it which the culture deems as insiders, justified, okay, and other groups that are unjustified outsiders. And then whatever those groups happen to do gets evaluated against that kind of backdrop. Clearly, some of the populist anger, and the political conflict there's been on both sides of the Atlantic over the past couple of years has been due to a challenge about who is it who gets to decide who is in and who is out. Who gets to decide in a society which are going to be the justified groups and which aren't. And the reason I take it that the world works this way is because, in a sense, this is the way God has designed it. You think back to the storyline of the Bible. Ever since the beginning, Genesis 3, God has divided humanity, hasn't he, into the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, those who trust God, those who are opposed to God. And God has declared that one group are the justified group and one group are not. And I guess mirroring this, human societies, which always try and take God's place, they end up setting up their own conflicting versions of who's justified and who's not. It's an attempt to create their own system independently from God's, their own categorizations, which inevitably are going to be different from his. And the reason that I give this intro, the reason that we need to be aware of this, if we're looking into the faith, if we are believers, is because this is part of the reason why it's going to be costly to side with Jesus. It's actually a wonderful thing, Christians will tell you, to be justified, to be accepted by the creator of the universe. But we need to know that receiving God's justification, receiving his acceptance, will almost certainly mean losing the justification and the acceptance of other rival systems, other rival gods, which are in opposition to him. And Jesus is going to explain this further in John chapter 15. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. So I put there on the sheets, siding with Jesus will mean being rejected by the world. This is a bit of a recap, really. If you were here last week, we saw this all being played out in that narrative in chapter 9. Here's a previously in John's Gospel moment, just to bring us up to speed for those who weren't here. Last week we saw there was a beggar. He'd been born blind, and then miraculously Jesus was able to restore his sight. He healed him, and this guy started to follow Jesus. He switched and sided with Jesus. And as he did that, he was immediately, this was chapter 9, 34, expelled from the synagogue, cast out by the society. And this, of course, is because there are rival systems at play. And I've labeled them here. There is the Pharisees' view and there is Jesus' view. The Pharisee system and Jesus' system. And understanding this will give us a really helpful intro as to what Jesus is trying to do in our section. So let me take you through. There's the Pharisees' view, which is that there's a God, and God is the one who has appointed them, the Pharisees, forgive the clip art, as shepherds or leaders over Israel. And then they get to determine who are the insiders, the sheep, and who are the justified, the accepted ones, and then who are the outsiders, the goats, the unjustified ones. And obviously, because Jesus deliberately ignores their system, he deliberately violates their man-made rules about the Sabbath, we saw that last week, they had already placed Jesus firmly in the unjustified category. He was out. But then in chapter 9, when the beggar, here he is, when he sided with Jesus, they automatically transferred him out of the sheep category into the goats category. I'm very, very proud of that, by the way. If you've been coming to Grace Church for a while, you have to put up with all kinds of things, but this is a new step for me. If you've been coming for multimedia excitement, you've had it. So I won't be offended if you leave. It doesn't get any better. But now in chapter 10... Jesus is stepping up and he's explaining his understanding, the real situation, namely that he, and not the Pharisees, is the one appointed by God. He's the true shepherd leader of God's people, the one the prophets had predicted, like we saw in Ezekiel 34. And that as people like this beggar recognize his voice and follow him, they show themselves to be true sheep. They show themselves to be true people of God. And here's the sting as Jesus speaks. He's not just displaced what the Pharisees think their job is, but Jesus is going to explain that the Pharisees are not simply not the true leaders, but their response to Jesus indicates they're not even members of God's people. They're not even amongst the sheep. And therefore, this teaching Jesus has given is a warning that the crowds need to recognize what's going on. There's two conflicting systems, and they should not listen to the other voices or be led astray by them. So once we've got that framework in place, we're going to look now at chapter 10, and we're going to see Jesus is speaking now to a crowd of people who have been listening for a long time to all of the wrong voices in their lives, perhaps like some of us, we've been listening to all the wrong voices. And Jesus is saying, even though listening to my voice will involve being rejected by a lot of those voices, the voices that we're so used to, it's definitely going to be the right decision for you. You should follow me because, and these are the three points on the sheep, only I, the true shepherd, know my sheep. Only I, the true shepherd, give real life to my sheep. Only I, the true shepherd, lay down my life for the sheep. That's Jesus' argument. And given that all of us here hear all kinds of voices in a given week, don't we? We're all kinds of voices asserting authority, defining what is right and wrong, and who is in and who is out. We need to listen carefully to Jesus and why his voice is the only one we should really trust. So let's get into Jesus' argument. I'll put there point one, only the true shepherd knows his sheep. In general, I try to avoid kind of sentimental Hallmark calendar pictures of rainbows or cuddly toys or that kind of thing. But this is one exception, the lamb being cuddled. And you'll see why. The verses really do speak of a very personal knowledge and care between the shepherd and the sheep, and this does capture it well. So let's look. Truly, truly, verse 1, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheep by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. We can understand that, can't we? Jesus is describing the Pharisees here and their fraudulent, unauthorized, illegitimate leadership of God's people. But, verse 2, he who enters by the door, the true, legitimate shepherd leader, is the shepherd of the sheep. To him, the gatekeeper opens. And just to give a bit of background, the picture here is of probably a few different flocks of sheep who at night time are then all put together into one sheepfold so they can be protected by just one guard who's called the gatekeeper. And the picture here is that when the true shepherd of the flock comes, he doesn't need to break in. He just comes to the door, the gatekeeper gives him a nod and lets him in. He's legitimate. Verse 3, the sheep hear his voice and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he's brought out all his own, he goes before them and the sheep follow him for they know his voice. Apparently it's true, even to this day in the Middle East, that a shepherd will go into a crowded sheepfold and his own sheep, even if they're mixed in with others, his own sheep will recognize his voice and follow him. And yet the bit here which slightly goes beyond, in fact in quite a big way, goes beyond normal shepherding practice back then or today, is that little bit in verse 3 where Jesus says he calls his own sheep by name. We got a bit of that at the beginning, didn't we? Sean, Flossie, mint sauce, or whatever it is. And Jesus is emphasizing here that the warmth and the intimacy with which he knows each one of his people. I want us to dwell on this for a moment. You see, when Jesus calls people to follow him. He doesn't just pitch up in a society and call out to people in general, hoping that someone, anyone, might want to listen. No, he comes and he calls us individually by name. James, follow me. Grace, follow me. And Jesus says, I have come for you. Fill in your own name. Follow me. I've come for you to call you. And the point here is that Jesus is not a stranger. Whether we know him yet or not, he already knows us. And he knows us right through, right to the bottom. I guess all of us have had people in our lives who know us a bit. You know, each from different chapters in our lives. And they know us from that section. But of course, Jesus, as our creator, he knows us completely. We heard in our Old Testament reading that in response to the bad shepherds of God's people, God promised that he himself would come and be the shepherd of his sheep. And now he has arrived and he speaks to us as our creator. And he says, I know you. Even before you were formed in the womb, I knew you. Even before you spoke your first words, I knew about it. When you had your first day at school, when that tragedy happened, I was there. And when no one else knew what you were going through, I knew how much it hurt. I know what people have said about you. I know your hopes. I know your dreams. I know who you really are when you're not sure yourself. Do you see here, verse 3, Jesus calls his sheep by name. And he calls us by name because he already knows us personally and fully. When we look up at the night sky, we all get to do it. We probably wait until we're out of London because you don't get much joy from it in London. But imagine, you know, you're somewhere where it's otherwise dark and you see all these beautiful stars above you and you just think, wow. And if you're a believer, you almost certainly add to that. You go, wow. And what's more, I know the one who made all of this. But perhaps even more breathtaking than that thought, next time we're in that situation, we're looking up, is to think this. Wow. And what's more, the one who made all of this knows little me. And he knows me through and through. And he has called me by name. The point is that Jesus is not just another stranger. He's not just another voice. He's not someone else barging into our lives. Another voice from the media, from the government, from our workplace perhaps, demanding we listen to them. We have enough of those voices in our lives. No, Jesus is the shepherd God. And the one who says to each of us, unlike those other voices, I know you. Right to the bottom, I care for you. Trust me, follow me. So there we see the first reason, I think, why it makes perfect sense for us to submit ourselves to Jesus. But there's a lot more where that came from. So let's look at point two. Secondly, only the true shepherd gives real life to his sheep. I think one of the things which keeps lots of people from even looking into the Christian faith is that objection that because being a follower of Christ means by definition we need to submit to him, that's what it means, why then would anyone in their right mind ever be willing to surrender their freedom like that? And a lot of people say, why don't we just follow no one? Why can't we just be independent? For some of us, perhaps we're believers and we actually sense the power of the logic ourselves. And if we're honest, and we might not express it like this, but if we're actually inclined to a kind of softer sort of discipleship without some of the hard edges that Jesus insists on. So we're happy to follow him in a kind of a way, so long as it's basically where we were going to go anyway. And if that's our assumption, I think the first answer Jesus would impress upon us, and I've put this on the sheets, is that we have got to follow someone. This is really important to grasp. The idea that we can be totally independent is an illusion. And Jesus reinforces this point in a number of ways throughout the passage. I wonder if you've played that game where you have to come up with the animal that you think best represents you, and then everyone else has to come up with the animal that they think best represents you, and obviously the comedy or the crying comes from comparing the results. And if you've got, you know, thick skin, why not have a go over a drink after the service? So where I think of myself as an eagle or perhaps a snow leopard, something like that, it turns out that others see me more as a terrier or a hairless vole. It's a bit harsh. Now, if you ask God in the Bible which animal all of us are most like, the answer is very easy. It's unequivocal. Just as in this passage, God repeatedly says all of us are like sheep. Actually, it's 400 times nearly in the Bible. So it's emphatic. We're like sheep. And the point about sheep is that they are famously stupid. I can say this because it's about me as well, but this is God's diagnosis of us. Not just stupid, but vulnerable. There was a story on the BBC about a group of shepherds in Turkey, and in the time that it took for them to eat breakfast, one sheep found a cliff and walked over the cliff, and then another, until, get this, all 1,500 had walked over the same cliff. And the only reason 1,100 survived is that the first 400 broke their falls. Just absolute carnage. As far as predators are concerned, a sheep is basically a ready meal. Most of them have got very little to protect themselves. It's just gorgeous lamb. And they can't even find food on their own. They need someone to lead them to pasture. And the reason Jesus repeatedly uses this description of us is because, like sheep, human beings need a shepherd. We need a leader. We need someone to care for us, to guide us, to protect us. And Jesus reinforces this point about us needing to follow someone by the way he keeps contrasting, I wonder if you notice this, following himself, not with following no one, but always with following a bad shepherd. We see it here in verse 8, all who came before me are thieves and robbers. And the point is that if we don't follow Jesus, we'll end up following a thief, verse 8, verse 10. Or a hired hand, verse 12. Like it or not, we will end up following someone or something. It's how we're made. It's a silly example, but at my school, there was a set uniform. Hair had to be off the collar. We had to wear a school tie, etc. But we thought, oh, we're not going to be conformist uniform wearers. We are just going to go crazy and wild. And what did we do? We grew our hair a little bit over the collar. We had our ties as short as possible. We wore very brightly coloured socks, and we were just crazy mad. Obviously, the irony was we weren't being independent at all. We were still very strongly followers. We were just conforming now to a different uniform, a uniform which the peer group had decided was the acceptable one. And bizarrely, even the view that I'm not going to be influenced by anyone, I'm going to decide myself what is right and what I will do, can I say that is hardly free thinking? That is exactly what our culture tells us to say every day. It's the biggest sheep move we can possibly make. And it's not just in terms of what to think that we end up following someone. We all end up latching onto someone or something for significance and purpose and affirmation and security. The atheist David Foster Wallace, whom The Guardian described as the most brilliant American writer of his generation, he gave a graduation address in 2005, and he said this: in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshipping. He's speaking as an atheist. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And you can imagine those words did not go down at all well in the atheistic community he was part of, because he's basically underlining Jesus' point here that human beings have to follow and submit to somebody or something for ultimate guidance and protection. And Jesus is saying the only question is whether we are going to follow the good shepherd, whether we'll follow the Lord Jesus, or whether we're going to follow someone or something who is going to let us down. We've got those two options. But even when we've grasped that we have to follow someone, I think this might be more where we're at in this room, many of us just assume that following Jesus is going to be dull and it's going to be restrictive. And I want us to catch that thought and try and challenge it when it crops up. The answer is, the reason why we do that is that we regularly buy into the devil's lie. It's the oldest lie in the Bible. You remember back in the Garden of Eden, serpent tried to convince Adam and Eve that God is a killjoy. God knows when you eat the fruit, you'll become like him. He's trying to hold you back. He's trying to spoil your fun. And we buy into that lie nearly, well, every day. Why do we do it? We could not have got it more wrong. Look at verse 10. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came, Jesus said, that they may have life and have it abundantly. Life to the max, life in relationship with our Creator, life as it was meant to be. And actually, if we pause at all and think about the logic here, it's kind of obvious. Just have a little look at God's creation all around us, and it includes incredible things like the Great Barrier Reef or supernovas. It includes sex and relationships and comedy and laughter and music. And how on earth is it that we conclude that life is going to be at its best when we ignore and disobey the blessing giver? Just argue that point for a moment. You'll see it doesn't make any sense. Clearly, the one who made us, the one who loves us, the one who made all of this, he is the one who is going to show us best how we can flourish in his world. It's obvious. And Jesus warns us that any snakish voice which tricks us away from following him, like the voice of the religious leaders in this passage, however reasonable, however attractive they may sound, these voices, Jesus says, have come to steal, kill, and destroy. We're not to listen to them. At David Foster Wallace's commencement address, after he'd made that point that everybody worships something, he said this: an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, he says, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they're where you tap real meaning in life, then you'll never have enough. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, you'll always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power, you'll feel weak and afraid. You'll need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, he says. Being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. And so it goes on. So the voice that says to us, you hear this voice, true freedom and security in life comes from, fill in the blank, having as much money as we can, or living for ourselves. Can I warn you, that voice comes to steal our contentment and to kill our integrity and to destroy our eternity. Or the voice which says to us, sex is no big deal. It doesn't have to be in the context of marriage. That voice comes to steal our purity, it comes to kill our conscience, it comes to destroy our relationships. Or the voice which says, so long as someone doesn't find out, it doesn't matter how we treat them or how we speak about them behind their backs. Well, that voice comes to steal dignity, kill trust, and destroy friendships. And so it goes on. We're surrounded, aren't we, by voices calling us to follow and pursue all kinds of things. And Jesus says that every voice that leads us away from him, you can count on it, it is going to end up robbing us, killing us, and destroying us. Only Jesus, and only submission to him, here's the paradox, gives us life to the full, both now and most significantly, eternally. So if we're hedging our bets, if we're in this group that, you know, we're only really following Jesus when it suits us, can I say you are missing out terribly. It's only when you start listening and following the shepherd that this life will come. So trust him. And the final knockdown reason here why it makes perfect sense to submit to Jesus is because, thirdly, on the sheets, only the true shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Verse 11, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for, or literally instead of, the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. A few years back, I was on the DLR, and I picked up a copy of the Metro. It's this article, and I read this. Hapless farmer gets cute puppy to look after his sheep, turns out to be a wolf. And it's a true story, apparently, of a Polish farmer thought he would get a sheepdog pup until evening came, and it started howling. And he was a clever guy, and he immediately called the police. They came, captured the wolf, because he knew that wolves do not think twice before tearing sheep apart. And like Ezekiel before him, in Ezekiel 22, Jesus compares the leadership of his day to wolves who devour the flock. We've already seen the way the Pharisees threatened and then cast out the beggar Jesus healed in that last chapter. And if this crowd will not recognize this leadership for what they are wolves, they will end up being led into destruction by them. Whereas Jesus, by contrast, is a leader who is so committed to their ultimate safety that he will stand between them and whatever danger they may face. And he will take the hit instead of them, even when it costs him his very life. All of us, I guess, will have heard about the terror attack in France in March earlier this year. There was an ISIS terrorist. He opened fire on a bunch of passengers in a car, killed one of them. Then he shot dead another two people. For then he took a woman hostage in the supermarket. And it was then that the police arrived, and Arno Beltram, a newly married police officer, he offered to take the woman's place as hostage while the negotiations took place. And sadly, there was more gunfire, and Beltram ended up being killed by the terrorist. Now, he gave his own life so that this woman, this hostage, could go free. And Beltram knew exactly what he was doing. He willingly offered to take her place, even though it cost him his life. And of course, that kind of heroism, and it's beautiful when you see it, it gives us just a little glimpse of the kind of selfless love, the kind of courage Jesus showed for us. And the reason Jesus is predicting it in advance in these verses, he wants us to be absolutely clear that what he's about to do, he's going to go to the cross for our sins. He's going to do it deliberately and willingly. Jesus knew exactly what he was doing. They didn't take his life. He gave it. But of course, one of the main things that makes Jesus' sacrifice different from Beltram's is the immeasurable value and dignity of the one who is giving his life. This is actually another of those places where Jesus gives a picture, but the picture breaks its banks. Because in Jesus' illustration, no Middle Eastern shepherd would actually choose to give his life for some dumb animals, just some sheep, especially the kind that run off cliff tops in their hundreds, these silly creatures. Even in human analogies, I've heard of bodyguards throwing themselves, taking a bullet for the president. I've never heard of a president throwing himself in front of a bullet for the bodyguard. You see, people don't tend to give their lives for those less significant. And yet the wonder of this is that what Jesus does, he does as the infinite Son of God. And he gives his life for his sheep, for little you and little me. Incidentally, this is one of the places in the Bible which makes it clear that when Jesus died, it wasn't for humanity in general, which would mean his death merely made people savable, but then people would have to cash in the check themselves, and that would be what makes the difference. No, verse 11, the good shepherd lays down his life for not everyone, just the sheep in particular. And we see later on, for example, verse 26, that is not everyone. The sheep are specifically those who will go on to hear his voice and follow him. And that means that Jesus' death doesn't just make someone save a bull. Jesus' death really saves, fully and completely. It even purchases the faith we need to receive it. In dying for us, Jesus doesn't just open a door with the hope that some people later might want to come through the door. No, in dying for us, Jesus picks us up, flings the door open, and carries us through all the way to safety. Jesus' death does everything necessary to save his sheep. What a savior. And the upshot of all this is that it explains why, for each of us here, following the Lord Jesus, even when, like the beggar, it means being condemned, even when it means being cast out by the society around us, just like he experienced, Jesus wants him and the rest of the crowd there to know whatever the cost is, it is definitely going to be worth it. And you and I need to be ready. We need to be bringing these truths to mind when we are tempted to let fear cripple our witness. After all, we all end up following someone. We all end up following something. That's the way we're made. But there is only one voice, only one person who truly knows us through and through. There's only one person who can give us life as it's meant to be. Relationship with our Creator now and forever. There's only one person who loves us enough to die for us. As one writer has put it, whatever else you're living for will not deliver. Your career will not die for you. Your achievements will not die for you. Jesus is the only Lord who, when we get him, will be satisfied. And when we fail him, he dies for us. And the call for each one of us day by day is to trust and follow this shepherd, even when that is going to be very costly personally, because we know he is the only one worth following. I'm going to leave a pause there. And there's some questions which might be a help to you as you reflect. And then in a moment, David will lead us in prayer before our question time.